Thanks again to everyone that's read. Helps us open the meeting and take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Big welcome to any visitors to our meeting tonight, and a huge welcome to anyone new to Narcotics Anonymous with us this evening. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So thank you. And yeah, we have a speaker tonight. It's going to fall on me to introduce them. This particular individual was one of the first people I met when I did my huge move from one end of the country to the other, and I wandered into a little meeting in the local town, and this man was there, and I always remember being made to feel very welcome, and I've kind of taken an interest and watched him as he's gone through his journey over the last few years. I have a huge respect for his commitment to recovery and a huge respect to his commitment to service in Narcotics Anonymous. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Simon, who's come along to share his experience, strength and hope with us tonight. 40, 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable. He's been around a day or three. I'll let him share that if he chooses to. So Simon, over to you. The floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. My name's Simon. I'm an addict.
Hello, Simon.
Hey, Simon.
Welcome.
Simon, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. You know, I say, my name's Simon, I'm an addict, and I say that with a little bit of pride in me today. I'm proud of the fact that I'm an addict that's made it into recovery. You know, I'm proud of the fact that I'm in recovery today. You know, none of which would be possible without the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, you know, I do a little history, and you know, I took my first drug at 11 years old, knowingly what the effects of what it would do to me, because I wanted to escape, I wanted to run away, I wanted the noise to stop. You know, and whether or not I was born an addict or it's in us or whatever, I don't know. You know, being an addict means to me is I haven't got an off switch. You know, once I put one in me, that's it. I'm up and running. And you know, in the reading there, the last one, one is too many, a thousand never enough. You know, and my first one is too many, because that kept me up and running for 30 years in addiction. You know, addiction stole from me. It stole moments of my life that I'll never ever be able to replace. You know, and it stole these things from me, and you know, it hurts me to think about them today, because they're moments that I can't even imagine. I can't even shut my eyes and try and remember, because I wasn't there. I wasn't there to see it. You know, addiction stole from me. It stole my son's first words. It stole his first steps. You know, because I wasn't there. You know, I was too busy using, I was too busy, you know, feeding my disease. You know, but like I say, and, you know, I put my first one in me, and I did that knowingly, and I wanted to. Like I say, I wanted to escape. I was adopted in 1971. So growing up, I was adopted. I'm mixed race, and I was adopted by two white people in the 70s, and that was kind of a little bit odd growing up. I was a little bit bullied, victimized, whatever you want to call it, different back then. And you know, and I also felt unloved and unwanted by my birth parents. You know, my adopted parents never hid from me that the fact that they picked me, they chose me, they adopted me, you know, and that I was adopted. And, you know, so there was that difference, that, you know, aloneness, I suppose, unwanted, unconnected. And that was difficult. And what I share today is about some of my history and some of my journey is, this is all stuff that I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous. This is all stuff I've learned by working the steps, by writing my steps, by looking at, you know, looking at me as an individual and trying to piece together, You know, I came into narcotics at the age of 41, and I'm trying to piece together the last 41 years of my life, you know, as I've been clean, you know, and it's still falling into place, some of it today, you know. So when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, my, you know, I had a good childhood in my head, you know. You know, when I got clean, I came in with the lie that I told myself, because I'd masked out all the horrific childhood that I actually did have, which was full of abuse at the hands of my adopted parents. It was mental, physical and sexual up until the age of 11. And so at that time, when I discovered, you know, realized that stuff that went on wasn't right and wasn't, you know, correct, I put that first drug in me, because my whole world fell apart. I tried to tell people what was happening to me. I tried to tell my grandmother, who brushed it under the carpet and told me to shut up. That didn't happen. I couldn't speak to a school teacher about that stuff because he was doing it to me as well. So all the doors were shut in my face, you know. That kind of stuff was hidden under the carpet, behind closed doors, wasn't talked about. I was alone, very much alone. And anyone that I wanted to listen to me wouldn't listen to me. But drugs did. Drugs listened to me, and drugs shut the noise up in my head. They took away the feeling of loneliness. They took away my feelings of fear. They took away my hurt, you know. You know, and that was me. That was my lot. You know, I went away. I ran away from home. I did various children's institutions and stuff, and growing up, and, you know, progressively my drug taking just moved up a level every time. And, you know, finally, at 17 years of age, I ended up in a job in the music industry. And to be honest with you, at 17 years old, I was a flat-out addict, junkie, whatever you want to call me. But I was kind of functioning. And, you know, I ended up with this job in the music business, and it was very well paid. Everyone around me was taking drugs, and no one was batting an eyelid, you know. And for an addict, you know, for an active addict, that's like winning the lottery, you know, almost getting paid to take drugs. In a funny sense of the word. And, you know, the people that weren't taking drugs, the people that weren't coming out on the all-night benders with us, and the people that weren't doing that stuff, they were the odd ones, they were the misfits, they were the weirdos, you know. And that stuff that kind of normalized my drug using, you know. It was normalized, you know. You know, I'd think nothing of someone being in my office, and then they tourniquet their arm, and then they shoot up. I didn't. It was normal. It's crazy to think about that today. You know. So you know, having money and being a functioning addict, all that did was higher my level of denial that I had around me being an addict and me actually even having a problem with drugs. Like I say, even when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I still didn't believe that drugs was a problem. I still didn't believe I was the problem, you know, but I'll get on to when I come into recovery. You know, I got married very young. You know, we had, like I say, we had a son. We were both in very good jobs. We were both addicts, you know, and this is the lie I told myself. And I told myself this lie right up until my first fourth step. You know, that we were good parents, we were doting parents, you know, but because we were so busy in our lives, in our work, and, you know, fast moving environment, we hired a nanny to look after our son because we were good people, you know. My first step four showed me that we hired a nanny so that we could take drugs. There's no way to sugarcoat that, you know. We hired someone to watch over our son so we didn't have to worry about him. You know, and hence I say, I didn't see his first steps, and I didn't hear his first words, but the nanny did. You know, she's got that moment imprinted in her mind. She's got that moment with her for the rest of her life. That's what drugs stole from me. You know, that's something I can never, ever get back, you know. And, you know, it's sad. It's sad, you know. And, you know, further down the line, you know, my drug taking got steadily worse. You know, I put myself into different scenarios that I wouldn't dream of putting myself in today, but I was still working. I lost jobs, I got jobs, but slowly but surely, you know, the disease was taking control of my life, but I was so in it and so blinkered that I couldn't see it. You know, I just accepted it and just soldiered on, you know, with my using. You know, further down the line, you know, obviously our marriage, you know, we lasted 6 years. I got out, or we got out from each other at the 7 year itch, as they call it. You know, my ex-wife's still in addiction today. You know, I'm here for her whenever she's ready. You know, my son's now 31 years old now, and I don't think he's an addict. He's a normal. I think he saw enough of his mum and myself, you know, to not send him that way, maybe. And he's studying to be a lawyer. You know, I'm proud of him today. You know, and I think he's proud of me today. But yes, so further down the line, you know, I got together with another using addict. You know, we thought we'd have a baby and it might make the world a better place and all that stuff. Like I say, you know, the step work has helped me piece together these moments of my life, helped me put into the real world as to what really happened and not what my disease told me happened and not how I played it out in my head. You know, to keep telling yourself the same lie over and over again, you begin to believe it. And I believed them. I believe these things when I come into Narcotics Anonymous, you know. You know, my daughter got to 3-4 years old, you know, she's wandering around the house. Our using had got a bit dark and really dirty this time round. And so being the good parents that we were, and this is how I told it when I came into Narcotics Anonymous before I did my first step four. This is how I told the story, is that we as good parents, we made a mutual decision to give our daughter to my partner's mum, to keep her in the family, to keep her safe, to keep social services from taking her away from us and putting her up for adoption or any of that stuff. We thought we were being well thought out, you know, very good parents, keeping it all in the family, and everything was lovely, you know, because it wasn't so nice in our house at that time, you know, and that's what I believed up until my first step four, you know. My first step forward, you know, it pieces together, you know, the fabric of the semblance of a life that I had. And, you know, I bullied, threatened and harassed my partner into giving away my daughter, our daughter, my own flesh and blood, so I could take drugs without the consequence of a kiddie running around the house. Fact. That is it. There's no ifs, no buts, you know. That's what the disease of addiction does to me, you know. Nothing will get in the way of my using when I use. That's how powerful this disease really, really is, you know. I definitely woke up and smelt the coffee when I put pen to paper around that gear, you know, and. Definitely a wake-up call to how powerful this disease really is and how malicious it is, you know. Anyway, you know, I soldiered on through life, you know, and I celebrated my 40th birthday by spending my children's money. That was in an account that I shouldn't have even been able to get anywhere near. But being the manipulative, conniving addict I was, I found a way into a kind of trust fund that was set up for them. And I spent celebrating my 40th birthday many, many thousands of pounds on a 3-month bender with people, some people that had known me all of my life. You know, I'm talking about 30 odd year friendships here, supposed friendships, you know, and looking back on it, not one of those people at any given time said, Simon, stop what you're doing. What are you doing? Give your head a shake. What are you, you're spending all this money. Why? You look at the state of you. You know, not one person in my life did that. You know, something had to give, and I still didn't see myself, you know, with a problem with drugs. Drugs were never the problem, ever. You know, because I was always managing to keep my head above water, always managing to kind of run a semblance of a house or a home or a flat or whatever. You know, but something had to change. And I remember the day, the first day that I knew it had to change. I was on the back end of a week-long bender, and I was sat on my friend's sofa. He'd just got a little Staffordshire Bull Terrier puppy dog. The puppy was about, I don't know, 2 months old. And I was sat on the sofa, 6:30 in the morning, wired. And I just had enough. I just had a feeling come over me, and I don't know what it was. I've had enough. I've had enough. And then I got up and went to the fridge and got a cold beer out. But I still remember that moment. That was the moment I'd had enough, but I wasn't sure of quite what I'd had enough of. You know, about 3 days later, I was speaking to a friend, and she was working on the other side of the UK, where I am now, roughly, in the UK, from London to where I am now. So probably, I don't know, about 100 miles, 150 miles, 100 miles. So she was working out this way, and I had a three-bedroom house, and I packed two bags and walked out of that house and decided to get in a car with her and get dropped off in a town just down the road called Gloucester. I was running from self. I was running from something. I wanted change, but I didn't know what I wanted to change. You know, someone could have gone into my three-bedroom house. They could have lived my life, because I left clothes in there. There was food in the fridge. There was electricity. There was all that. Someone could have just walked in my house and started living in there, and it was all would have been all right. I just packed a couple of bags and walked. She dropped me off, and on the way there, I'd managed to Google the homeless shelter or the day centre for homeless people. She'd locked me in her house prior to me coming to Gloucester for a couple of days and only let me have alcohol, the liquid. And anyway, I got to this kind of day centre. They managed to put me into a hostel for the night. And then this is my last year of my using, and it's probably the most horrific time of my using and a horrific time of my life. You know, but it still wasn't enough to stop me some of the situations that went on. You know, I got into that thing of going to the day centre during the day to get high off other people's medication because there was a doctor's upstairs, doing what I had to do to get my street drugs, going back to the night shelter at night if I made it there on time, or I had to sleep rough in car parks, you know. But I knew I still wanted something to change, and I don't know what. I still didn't know what it was. And I interacted with some kind of services. Someone did get me to an NA meeting about twice in that year, my last year of using. And I actually remember two of the people that were in that meeting, and they're still around me today. You know, I don't remember too much about the meetings, but I remember the people that were in there and how kind and loving and caring they were towards me, you know. And I was still using, but they just were happy that I was in a meeting and in a warm place for that hour of my life, you know. But like I say, I was interacting with services, not knowing what was really going to happen, what I wanted, you know. And during this time there, you know, I managed to manipulate the council to give me a flat. I sat at a desk with a guy opposite me from the housing place, and I stuck drawing pins in my legs to make myself have tears in my eyes when I was bullshitting him and manipulating him to get a flat. And I managed to get a flat. It wasn't in one of the best places. It was on the front line in Gloucester, and you know, it became a shooting gallery. It became a place for the ladies of the night to come and use in before they went out, you know, with their punters and stuff. And it, you know, it was a all for all. And up the road there was a probation house, you know, for criminals that were on lifers that were come out from prison. And the police were at my basement flat in that street more times in that 6 months that I was in that flat than they ever were at the probation office, you know. And that just kind of speaks volumes about what was going on at my place of residence. And I was attacked in that flat. It was a basement flat, so it had a spiral staircase coming down off the street, and there was no back door. It was a tiny little place, and so it was one way in and one way out. Two addicts pushed their way into my flat, attacked me, assaulted me, beat me up. They then covered me in tomato ketchup, and they were going through my kitchen knife drawer to find a knife to stab me. And they covered me in ketchup so that when the paramedics turned up, they wouldn't be able to find the wounds in order to treat them. Those two addicts, all they stole from me was a BlackBerry phone and a pair of Nike trainers. That was where my life had become worth. A pair of trainers and a mobile phone. You know, when I came round, my first thought was to go in school. It still wasn't enough to stop me using. You know, anyway, like I say, I was interacting with services and stuff and whatever, and I don't know what happened. I ended up doing all the right things and making all the right noises, and you know, and I managed to get into a detox unit, and I was even, and they'd offered me a residential rehab for 6 months, and I went, typical addict's going to get in the way of my using. 6 months? No, I'll take the detox. Which was for a maximum of 2 months. And someone came to see me from the residential rehab. I signed some paperwork that I don't remember signing. And 12 days later, out of a 2 month detox, I was in a residential rehab. And yeah, and 2 days after that, I was in my first NA meeting. I'm going to say semi-clean. I hadn't used for probably about 14 to 15 days. So I'm going to say semi-clean because my head was still a bag of mashed potatoes. You know, I was in my first NA meeting, and I was given the white booklet, which I still have in my bookcase today. And I took that booklet back with me, back to the residential rehab I was staying in, and I read that, and I read Who is an Addict in there, and every word resonated with me. You know, the sentences, the way it was worded, what it was saying, it spoke to me. You know, the words jumped out, and I kind of felt connected to something for the first time in a very long time. You know, and part and parcel of being in that residential rehab was that we had to attend a minimum of 2 meetings a week, you know, just in order to, you know, do what they expected of us. And that's what I did. And we were lucky enough there, even though we could get out to meetings, we were lucky enough there to have H&I come in, you know. And, you know, it still touches a chord with me today, even though that I've done this service as well. I've done H&I services. Is the fact that people were coming in on a Sunday afternoon to carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous to us. People were coming away from their wives, husbands, their children, their families, their Sunday roasts, They were giving up their time to come in to talk to us, to carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. That spoke volumes to me about what this fellowship is. And the beauty of an H&I meeting, you know, is that, you know, it's like a normal meeting, but the added part of that is they allow us to ask questions to the people that have come in from H&I. They allowed us to ask questions about the fellowship, about what it was, about kind of how it worked, what was a sponsor, you know, what's in the basic text, what do we need to do here, you know, what are those four suggestions, you know, and because it says we ought never be organized, or I can't repeat literature for the life of me. I'm not a sort of schooling head. I'm a street head. I can't remember stuff very, very great. I can read it and take it in, but I can't repeat it. NA ought never be organized, or something is in one of our readings in our literature. And because NA ought never be organized, sometimes H&I, for whatever reason, didn't turn up. And the Sundays that they didn't turn up, for whatever reason, were the Sundays that we thought we knew enough about it, and we cobbled together our own NA meetings in the rehab. Just the residents, no one else. We kind of knew how it was done. We knew what the readings were. You know, and then once someone would, you know, chair the meeting, secretary the meeting, and then one of us would choose to share. You know, and there'd only be like, you know, a maximum of 10 of us in some of these meetings on a Sunday, on our own, doing our own NA meeting as we thought, you know, using the literature, using the readings, and one of us would share. And those meetings were some of the most powerful meetings that I went to in my early days, because there was no outsiders and there was no one in the room. It was just us. We went down to the bare roots of what we were sharing, and it enabled us to learn about that honesty and sharing honesty with each other. And we shared some really beautiful moments cobbling together our own NA meetings in there, you know, and you know, I'll never forget that. You know, that resonates with me, and that's kind of quite how powerful this stuff is, and how it kind of rubs off or works on people, and you know, and I'm grateful for that. You know, I am grateful for that. You know, I managed to get service whilst I was in treatment. It was only as a door greeter at one of the meetings that we attended. I managed to get service about a month before I left, and I was doing that service. So when I left the treatment facility, I did what was suggested. Find a sponsor, and I actually found a sponsor through the H&I that came into that treatment center. And it was a guy who came in, and he'd had throat cancer, so he spoke really nicely and really calmly, and he was like, it was kind of gruff but smooth. And there was something about him. He wore sandals and wore cardigans, and it was kind of Buddhist in his ways, and spiritual, and the exact opposite of what I was. And I thought, I love some of that. You know, we were like chalk and cheese, me and this guy. And so I had a sponsor when I left. You know, I'm still friends with him to this day. He's not my sponsor today. We parted ways after about a year and a half. We parted ways. But, you know, I'm forever grateful for him, because, you know, I was like a Tasmanian devil in my first year and a half of recovery, and some. You know, I was, you know, it was like someone had hit me with a cattle prod, and I was just mad and mental, you know, clean and crazy, if you want to call it that. You know, but this guy was so gentle, caring, loving and compassionate to me, you know, he helped me, man. He helped me. And he put up with, you know, to put it honestly, he put up with my shit, you know, because I'd never been clean before. you know, from that age of 11 all the way through to the day I got clean, I'd used. You know, I didn't have, like I say, there was no off switch for me. And I already had service, you know, and I started working the steps. And, you know, steps in the beginning for me, that it kind of, you know, I'm not educated and I wasn't at school very much, you know, but I remember what homework was. And doing step work kind of felt a little bit like homework to me in the early days, you know. But, you know, putting pen to paper and I understand how it kind of works for me is the power of the pen and then the power of sharing what I've put down on paper to someone else. You know, there's two parts to step work, you know, the power of me actually putting the pen to paper, you know, the thoughts come down my, you know, in my brain, down to my arm, into the pen, onto the paper, and you know, the thought and think and write process there, you know, and then reading back what I've written, seeing it in another light when I read it out with a sponsor, you know, it's powerful and beautiful all at the same time, you know. But I got to, like I say, we parted ways, and I'd only got up to step three with this guy, you know. I continued to do service. I probably took on a lot more service than I should have done early doors. You know, I was a bit of a, for want of a better term, an NA Nazi, you know, in my first 3 years at least of recovery, I was a little bit, you know, meetings or die, and I'd yell everyone in the dry house to get to a meeting or die and all that. And, you know, funnily enough, there was a guy in there that used to do one meeting a week in another fellowship. But anyway, that was all he did. And then the rest of the time, all he would do, the furthest he would go every day, was to get up in the morning, go and get the newspaper from the local shop and come back to the dry house. That was his lot until I got in there and was, you know, meetings, meetings, meetings. And funnily enough, it upped his game. And the guy's still clean today, you know. And like I say, I probably took on too many service positions. You know, I wanted to fix everything, fix me, fix the world, you know, do as much as I could for Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I'd tell everyone that I could about NA, you know, from the little old woman at the bus stop to the woman that was serving me in the local checkout at the supermarket. You know, everyone had to know about Narcotics Anonymous and that I was in recovery and how great it was, you know. I still didn't really know who I was, you know. I came in here not knowing a thing about me, you know. I came in here not knowing what colour I liked. I came in here not knowing, I didn't know anything, you know. And that's another thing that, you know, that I didn't expect to get from Narcotics Anonymous, you know. I'll get to that, you know. Like I say, step work showed me about my real actions and not the actions that I thought I did, that as I portrayed them in my mind. And like I say, about my, you know, my first step four showed me about what really happened around my daughter as opposed to what I thought happened. And, you know, I got to it, you know, I'm jumping a bit here, but yeah. And I still thought I kind of knew best a little bit. And I didn't kind of listen to what people were saying to me. I hadn't had any connection with my daughter since she was 8 years old. And I got to a year clean. I'm on that pink fluffy cloud of recovery. There's rainbows and unicorns coming out. It was something like, I don't know, like the movie Bambi, when they're all singing in the forest and the little butterflies are flying everywhere and it's all beautiful and fluffy and it's lovely. And I decided that I knew best. And I picked the phone up to Jan, my daughter's grandmother, where she was living, to speak to my daughter, you know. His happy, shiny new daddy, you know. I never got to have the conversation I envisioned in my head, because my daughter wouldn't come to the phone. I can hear her in the background. I don't want to talk to him. Don't want to talk to him. I got knocked off that pink ladder recovery I was on. The real world finally slapped me in the face. And the lesson I learned from that was that just because I've made a change, just because I'm clean, just because I haven't used for any period of time, doesn't make everything all right, doesn't make the world a better place, and doesn't let me pass go and collect £200 without any consequences. And this is the first consequence of my actual act of addiction that I've had to come to terms with at a year clean, was that my own daughter doesn't want anything to do with me. I'm 9 years, 5 months and 7 days clean today. My daughter still wants nothing to do with me. I still haven't had a conversation. I've chosen to listen to what has been suggested to me now. You know, I send cards, I send her letters, whether or not she's reading them, whether or not she's, I know they're getting passed on to her, but, you know, whether or not she's reading them, whether or not she's doing whatever with them, I don't know. I haven't had any kind of response. I haven't had any phone conversations. And as a consequence of my act of addiction, you know, I have a 19-year-old daughter that wants nothing to do with me. I wake up every morning and she's the first thought in my head, you know. But this program has taught me, and the people in it have shown me, if I dwell on that, if I feed that, I don't know. It's not. Is it a resentment? If I feed whatever thought it is around my daughter that I have, and I keep feeding it, I guarantee that by lunchtime, it could overpower me, and I could be in the next crack house, you know. But I've learned enough. Is it's all right to have the thought, and it's all right to feel sad, but I don't have to live in it, you know. And the best thing I can do that the program's taught me is to stay clean a day at a time. And this is the other thing I've learned from Narcotics Anonymous, is to have acceptance. Acceptance is massive. You know, it doesn't mean it's all right. It doesn't mean it's okay at all by any stretch of your imagination. But acceptance is massive. Because my head fell off when she didn't want to talk to me. I isolated in the dry house I was in. I didn't go to meetings. I stewed on it for 2 weeks. I wanted to go and use. And I locked myself away. And it wasn't until I went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and I shared what had happened. And I broke down and I cried in front of people. And I can probably count. I haven't cried more than 5 times since I've got clean. I'm not a crier. I'm not. Even though the last year or so, I've had a few tears in my eyes when I've been sharing in meetings and doing a main sharing. I've had a little frog in the throat, so maybe I'm thawing out a little bit. But I broke down and cried in the meeting and shared what had happened. And other members of Narcotics Anonymous held me, cuddled me, told me, loved me. And they told me, look, it'll be all right, just don't use. No matter what, just don't use. And then other members came and shared their experiences they'd had and with their own children coming into recovery, you know. And, you know, like I say, I've took that on board, and 9 and a bit years later, you know, I still have no contact with my daughter. You know, but like I say, all I can do is be here, and I accept the fact. I accept the fact that she may never come back in my life. She may never want to talk to me. I'm not okay with that. Of course I'm not. But I accept that that's her decision today. You know, that's something else that this program's taught me, is to, you know. And that was something my first sponsor told me, was, you know, when I was losing my shit around her not talking to me. You know, I want to go and kidnap her. How dare she? I'm her dad. Hang on a minute, Simon, he said. Sit down. Rest your head a minute. why don't you put her shoes on and look at how she might have visualized everything that's gone on around her in her little short life, everything that you might have put her through and how she's interpreting all that, you know. And that was one of the first times in my life that I'd actually looked at something from someone else's point of view and actually looked at how my behaviors might have affected someone else, you know. Because I'm an addict, man, and I'm selfish, you know. I'm mean, I'm arrogant, and I'm nasty, you know, when I use. You know, it's a different kettle of fish when I'm not using. You know, and that's it, and that's how I deal with it today. I accept that fact. I do accept that fact anyway. And funnily enough, 2 days ago, 2 days ago, I had to move a client, one of our female clients in where I work. I work in a rehab now, funnily enough. Yeah, it only took me 8 years to go to work in a rehab, though. I refused to do it. I would not do it. I'm not going to go and work there. But COVID kind of kicked my butt, and it's probably one of the best things I've ever done. But anyway, one of my clients had to go and get her stuff from social housing that she was in before she came to us at the rehab. And so me and another guy have driven her down there, and she's given me the postal area, the postcode for the address that we're driving to. I went, whoa, hang on a minute. Are we going to Wandsworth? And she's gone, yes. The next thing I know, the car, we're driving through where my daughter is. It's the first time in 9 and a bit years that I've been back to that part of London. I've avoided it on all costs of not going there. And I'm there. And do you know what hit me? Will I recognise my daughter if I drive past her in the street? Will I know it's her? I've not seen her for 11, 12 years, give or take, you know. She's a woman now. She's not a little kiddie anymore. She's a grown woman in her late teens, early 20s. Would I recognise her? Was my thought. And I kind of had a sweat and a panic on, you know. And like I said at the beginning of my day, you know, that's something recovery, you know, the gift of recovery is that I'm clean today. But the disease of addiction is a thief. The biggest thief I'll ever meet, because it stole that from me, of me not knowing to be able to recognize possibly my own daughter, my own flesh and blood. Addiction stole that from me. You know. But anyway, you know, I got through it, and you know, it's one of those things, and I kind of really, I got through it, and I got through it clean, you know. I've been homeless in my recovery, you know. I kind of manipulated, as we do. I'm still an addict at heart. I might not be an active addiction, but I'm still an addict, you know. And I still have that way of thinking, and I can still truly manipulate if. You know, and I tried to manipulate social housing here where I live now, and I'm into getting a place. So I kind of forced the issue to get thrown out of the dry house I was in to overstay my welcome there, and kind of manipulated that to make them make me homeless. You know, so I've been homeless in my recovery. I didn't use. I got through it. You know. I haven't mentioned, you know, God or a higher power in my show yet, you know, because at 11 years old, you know, I went to church, I went to Boys Brigade, I did all that, you know, church stuff, I was in the choir and all that stuff, you know, and at some points, if I'd been naughty, I got caught nicking bikes once, and the police brought me home. And waiting there was the vicar. My dad had called the vicar, you know, and they talk about the fear of God. Our vicar at the time was a big black dude. He must have been, in my eyes, he was 7-8 feet tall. He was massive. He was a big booming vicar. And that's the kind of way it was. So when I, you know, once I hit 11 and my kind of childhood fell into place, there was no God in my life. How dare there be a God? How dare they make me go to church when that happened to me? You know, how could there be a God if that happened to me? So when I came into recovery, you know, the word God, you know, looking through the steps, you know, when they're printed up on the wall in a meeting, you know, seeing that word God, kind of scary, kind of filled me, you know, with fear. You know, I do use the word God today. And I have the understanding that I do have a higher power today. Because if I didn't, I don't know how the hell I'd be talking to you. I wouldn't be talking to you right here, right now, if there wasn't a higher power in my life looking out for me. There's things that are, you know, that we've probably all been through on here, life or death experiences. And all you guys on here today are all here. You're all living testimony that there is a higher power and that your life has got meaning and purpose because you're here in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, you know. So I am a firm believer. I don't know quite what it is. Like I say, I'm not the religious type, but I use the word God. I believe in the higher power, spiritual, the wind, the air, the universe, whatever it might be. There's something bigger and better and greater than me that loves and cares for me when I can't do that for myself. And also lets me trip over now and again and lets me make those mistakes and learn from them. You know, but moving on, you know, the sponsor I've got now, I think I've had for 8 and a bit years, give or take. He's one of the most loving, caring men I've ever had in my life. You know, looks can be deceiving. You know, he's a 6 foot mixed race guy. He's got a big scar on his face, man. He looks like he wants to eat you for breakfast and spit you out the bones and that. But do you know what? He's the most loving, caring man I've got in my life. And the relationship I've got with him is something I never, ever thought I would ever have with any man in my life. There's nothing I wouldn't tell that man. And like I say, you know, my first step four, you know, clearing the wreckage of my past. We sat in his car on a beach in Western Supermare. It's not the most beautiful of places in the world. It sounds idyllic, but it's not. But as you look out from the beach there on the coast, there's a couple of islands. You can watch the waves rolling in and out, and it's okay, you know. It's a lot better than looking at a 4x4 in a prison cell, I'll tell you that much. So, you know, that was where I read out my first step four, you know. And I shared some stuff in there, you know, and I disclosed some things in there that, that stuff that you're going to take to your grave with you that no one else is ever going to know, you know. But by working my first three steps, because I redid my first three steps with this sponsor and building a relationship with him, and a little bit of outside therapy, I might have to add, at the words of my sponsor because of my trauma that I'd suffered as a child. When I finally got round to reading out this step four, it was no holds barred in there. You know, I've heard people say it in the rooms, how free do you want to be? You know, as free as I want to be is as honest as I want to be. You know, and I'm as honest as I will be overly honest if I have to be. It's just because I don't want to be tied to those chains anymore. You know, I don't want to be chained down with addiction and that simple little saying, secrets keep you sick. Yeah, they do, man. You know, yeah, there's secrets. Yeah, I'm gonna keep a surprise party hidden from someone and tell a little white lie because we're gonna surprise you for your birthday. Yeah, that's all right. That's a little secret and that's a little white lie. That's a good thing, you know. But hiding that stuff. And the most powerful thing that happened in that car when I read that first step four out was me too. Me too. Especially around the abuse I suffered as a child. Me too. We hugged and we cried, you know, and I never, ever, ever thought that I, in a million years, that I'd ever, ever have a relationship with a man like I do with that man, with my sponsor. I'm still, my relationships with men, I know men, I have acquaintances of men, if that call it that, as far as I let it go, I'm still very quite strange with men. It's just me and it's just the way I am, and that's just my trauma reaction. It's getting better, you know, I'm thawing out a little bit now, you know, and that's because I do this stuff, you know. I'm on my second set of steps at the moment, and I'm not got complacent in my recovery, because I know complacency has no place in my recovery. Steve, if I'm running near time, just jump on me because I'm not reading chats or anything like that.
Mate, brother, you're good.
All right, okay. So yeah, I'm on my second set of steps. And I'm not complacent with my recovery in any way, shape or form. You know, I've always had service since I came into recovery. I've always had a service position, apart from about 2 weeks where I pulled away from everything at one point because I'd overloaded myself again. And I got to about a week of no service and I just didn't like it. I didn't have anywhere I was meant to be. I didn't have, you know, and I didn't like it, you know, and I don't count sponsorship as part of service. Service is me turning up or me doing service for carrying the message of Narcotics Anonymous. That's service to me. That's service, you know, H&I, PI, you know, on the area, working, making tea and coffee, whatever it is, whatever needs doing in order to carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous. But that's service to me. And I don't like not having it. So I've more or less always had service since I've been clean. Or since I left that facility, I've always had a sponsor. I've not been without. I felt a bit bad when I asked my sponsor now to sponsor me because I hadn't got rid of my first sponsor. I felt a little bit like I was cheating on a girlfriend. But, you know, it was time for us to part ways. And why should I try and force something to work? And why should I, you know, willy-nilly let him sponsor me when it's not working, when I can free him up to sponsor someone else who could be helped, and then also I'm holding back my own recovery. So, you know, I've always had a sponsor. I've always either been doing step work or working a tradition since I've been clean, and I've always had regular meeting attendance, even up until COVID last year. And then a couple of us put our heads together and we put some meetings on that Zoom platform, and some of them are still going today, which is great. So I did that as well, the Zoom thing, and I'm so grateful, you know, that COVID's kind of not gone away, but we were able to open face-to-face meetings again now, you know, and I'm truly grateful for this platform and platforms similar, for helping the millions and millions of addicts around the world stay connected. You know, like I say, we're a resourceful lot, man. You know, nothing stopped us in our using. We always found ways and means to get more. And the way I look at the way Narcotics Anonymous moved itself onto the platform of Zoom and Blue Jeans and other various platforms within a matter of days, if not hours, when COVID struck 2 years ago. We're a resourceful bunch, man, and we do chase our recovery like we chased the drug, you know. And that, you know, that's the way of turning a bad thing good, you know. And Zoom has been really helpful, and I've watched people on that platform get clean, stay clean on there, you know, and then come into the rooms. And the funny thing is, I'm still meeting people now in the rooms that have been on Zoom, and it's kind of weird when you kind of give them a hug for the first time because you've only seen them on a little square for the last 2 years, you know, and then they're suddenly in front of you, but you kind of feel like you already know them, but you haven't had that physical experience with them, and it's kind of odd, but it's beautiful, and it shows that you know that this program works, in whatever format. But it only works if you work it, you know. And I, you know, did I give recovery my best shot today? Have I reached out to another addict? I've made a couple of calls this morning. I haven't been to a meeting today. Because because I haven't been to a meeting today. That's it. You know, I at the moment, I try and get myself to at least 2 physical meetings a week. That's a minimum for me here. I don't drive. You know, I've still got service at the newcomers meeting, the meeting I went to as a newcomer when I was in the treatment centre. That's been my home group since I've been clean. You know, and I've still got service there. You know, I've got sponsees that I'm taking through the steps. You know, I'm going back to the steps, actually. You know, like I said, I'm on my second set of steps, and I've struggled and battled with my mental health as well over the last 4 years, and I'm on a step 6, I don't say this lightly, and I don't say it in any way, shape or form. Please do not ever do this, ever. Been on step 6 for about 4 years. It's my second step 6. I'd like to think I've got no defects of character. A few years in, I've worked the steps already. I've gone through the traditions. I'm on my second set, and I'd like to think I've got no defects of character whatsoever. I'll turn around to my sponsor. I'm going to say, I'm not writing 100 defects like I did first time round. I just want to write the ones that are going to take my ass out the door today. And I've kind of been battling with myself whether my defects play into my mental health or my mental health plays into my defects. And I have absolutely been kicking my ass. And yeah, I'm on the last leg of it now. I've had it open for 4 years. You know, life's got somewhat busier, etc., etc. I'm not complacent. I keep telling myself I'm not complacent, you know. But I'm on the last 4 or 5 questions on it now at the Green and Gold. But yeah, I've had a step 6 open for a long time, and I don't suggest that to anyone. I've been tested in that last 4 years. I've had deaths, I've had births, I've had good times, I've had bad times. I haven't had to use any of them, you know. Have I got reservations today? I probably have, but I couldn't tell you honestly. I'd like to think that I work enough of a program today, in all its forms and all its components, and I've got enough about me that I could get through anything clean, you know. And a testament to that is watching other addicts share their stories and share what they've got through clean, you know. And my little ego will jump on that. Well, if they did it, so can I, you know. If they did it, so can I. You know, and I kind of like that, and that's what we do. You know, it is a we program. You know, I very much cannot do this on my own. You know, and I was told off by someone in a meeting once because I said, this is my first time that I've ever been clean. And he went, no, this is the only time you've been clean, because if you call it once, you're opening the door for a relapse. You're opening the door to put another number on there. So, you know, I say that this is the only time I've been clean. Recovery's not for the faint-hearted. It's not easy either. You know, if doing this stuff, what I've done in the last 9 years was easy, I'll stop using tomorrow. I'm not doing all that again, man. You know. It used to scare me. It used to fill me full of dread when I first came in. What, I have to do this forever? What, forever and ever? Yes. Do you know what? Narcotics Anonymous is woven into the fabric of my life today. And my life is woven into the fabric of Narcotics Anonymous. It's kind of, it's a bit of both. And I have to put my recovery first, no matter what. No ifs, no buts. I know that. But I still have a life as well, you know, and I do notice it when I don't do enough meetings. I do notice it when I don't connect, You know, I do feel my head getting a little bit heavier. You know, I'm still growing. You know, like I said, I'm 9 years, 5 months, and 7 days today, and you know, God willing, and I don't take this as a given. I don't. God willing, I will make it to 10 years this year. You know, I didn't even think I was going to collect the first 6 months of chips when I first started collecting the key rings. I didn't. And then looking at the black one all the way down the end of the table there, I'm looking, I ain't getting that. And you know what? I've just kept collecting them. You know, I've just kept waking up. I've kept coming back. I haven't picked up. You know, I've reached out where necessary. You know, I've done the work. You know, I do the service. I do the writing. You know, and it works. It works. You know, if anyone got anything from my share today, thank you. Thank you for listening. If anyone didn't, keep coming back. You might hear your story. And anything good or positive that I said that might work for you, that's definitely Narcotics Anonymous. And anything that was gobbled and gobbledygook, that was just me. All right. So if any of it made any sense, that's Narcotics Anonymous. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your day. And I wish you all the best. Thank you.